Well, good evening, everybody. Nearly have a full house, and there's no doubt two or three more to come, but I think we should get underway. I welcome you to this, the second of this year's Dean's Lecture Series. It's a particularly special event. It's a special event for two reasons. One, it's Professor Steve Dinham's inaugural professorial event address. But it's also the first public lecture that we've held in our new space in the Graduate School of Education. Clearly, this building offers fantastic facilities not only for our staff but our students as well. So after the lecture, we're going to christen the new building in the foyer outside, and you're all invited to help us christen it. I'm going to introduce the Provost, Professor John Dewar, in a few seconds, but I acknowledge Professor Ron Slocum, who's President of the Academic Board, who is here, and also Professor Pip Patterson, who's the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Academic. I'm delighted that you've been able to join us. The Graduate School is committed to working with a variety of partners, and it's fitting that tonight's lecture actually represents that partnership. It's a partnership that the Graduate School has through Professor Dinham and the Australian Institute of Teaching and School Leadership. And that tonight's lecture talks a little bit about that relationship and where it goes. But before proceeding, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people. They're the traditional custodians of this land. And I do pay my respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians present. I have sincere apologies from Minister Peter Hall. He wanted to be here tonight, but he was asked by the Premier to represent the Premier at another function, and he's very disappointed indeed that he can't be here. But in his stead, I'm delighted that I invite the University's Provost, Professor John Dewar, to introduce Stephen and to welcome you all. Please welcome Professor Dewar.
Thank you very much, Field. I'd like to begin by congratulating you, Field, and your colleagues in the Graduate School on having the vision that has led to the creation of these spectacular new premises, which have only opened very recently. It's part of a program of refurbishment that we've been undertaking across the university, particularly focusing on providing outstanding learning spaces for our graduate schools. And I think this gives you a very fine example of what we've been able to achieve with some fairly modest buildings, but some imagination and vision what we can bring about. So congratulations to Field and his colleagues in the Graduate School of Education. And I think it does provide us with a home that's worthy of the high ideals of one of Australia's finest schools of education. Now, my happy task tonight is to introduce Professor Steve Dinham. But before doing that, I just want to recall some of the guiding vision which informs the work of the Graduate School of Education, which I think is relevant to Steve's talk to us tonight. And that is that the Graduate School works to create a society in which education enables full and equitable participation. Now, tonight's inaugural professorial lecture will take us to the cutting edge of debate on that very important social objective. Because in Australia today, as I'm sure you will know, the debate on national teaching standards takes us right to the heart of this issue of social inclusion and equity. Now, as one of the most influential scholars researching in this field, Steve has played a really important role in shaping the draft national teaching standards for teachers and principals. And again, as I'm sure many of you know, these are now taking on a form of life of their own through the labours of AITSL, the Australian Institute for Teaching and School Leadership. This close engagement with the national standards means that Steve is really well positioned to comment on the many factors that impact on teacher quality, and the retention of teaching staff, including issues to do with salary and career structures. And I suspect that no one here needs to be told how important these themes are and how intimately connected they are to the challenge of social disadvantage. The scholarly community more generally, but particularly that in faculties of education like this, is also well aware of the strong connections between educational attainment, opportunity and success. And we know in particular that good teaching and good schooling are absolutely vital in the struggle to overcome disadvantage and to build a more inclusive and equitable society. And we can look forward with confidence, I think, to Steve guiding us skillfully on this issue tonight. But of course, it's one thing to affirm the importance of good teaching and good schooling, but quite another to make it all come about. And on that score, I'd like once again to pay tribute to the wonderful work being done here at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, particularly through its Master of Teaching programme. If I were to allow Field to address you on this subject, which is probably a topic for another occasion, he would tell you that his ambition and those of his colleagues is no less than to transform the teaching profession in this country. And with that very modest objective, it provides an important context, I think, for what Steve is going to be telling us tonight. But one point that I have heard Field make, and it's a really good one, is that on graduation, 90% of our Master of Teaching graduates say that they feel either very well or well prepared for life in the classroom. This compares dramatically and very favourably with earlier evaluations of undergraduate teacher education programmes in Australia and overseas, where the figure is usually well below 50%. So it's evident that this graduate school is doing something not just very distinctive, but something really positive that is taking it well on the path to achieving it, that ambition to transform the teaching profession in this country. So from a national perspective, but also from the point of view of this university, tonight's lecture is a significant moment. And it's my pleasure now to introduce and to say a few introductory words about our speaker, Steve Dinham, as the university's inaugural professor of teacher education. Stephen came to the university earlier this year with a well-established reputation as one of Australia's leading experts on teacher education. He was previously research director at the Australian Council for Education Research, ACER, and before that he's taught in government secondary schools in New South Wales and at the universities of Western Sydney, New England and Wollongong. He has an extensive list of publications, of which I'm only going to mention one, and that is his book, published in 2008, How to Get Your School Moving and Improving, which some of you may have read, which has been extensively used, particularly by newly appointed principals, as an invaluable guide to managing and improving the teaching workplace. Steve has also proved himself, I might say, to be a wonderful contributor to the senior leadership team in the Graduate School of Education. As you can see, he's also the Director of Learning and Teaching in the Graduate School, and I know from my interactions with him and with the leadership team in the Graduate School what a great contribution he's making on that front. But tonight, he's speaking to us as a scholar and as an expert in his field of expertise. The title of his lecture is Let's Get Serious About Teacher Quality, The Need for a New Career Architecture for Australia's Teachers. So it's now my real pleasure to invite Steve to deliver his inaugural professorial lecture on this. Please welcome Professor Steve.
Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you, Phil, for the invitation, which I could hardly refuse. I actually wrote this lecture a little while ago, and I was just reflecting this morning on where it had come from, because you can sort of forget where the journey's been. So I just sort of reflected back, and I think really this started with my PhD, which I completed in 1992, which looked at teacher resignation. It's a very positive topic. But it looked at teacher satisfaction, motivation, and you know, the sort of things that attract people to teaching and the reasons why they leave. And that led to a much larger study with Catherine Scott, who's in the front row, which it was a more of a quantitative study, which we conducted across about 8 countries in total. It's still going, it's still being replicated. And that was an attempt to sort of quantify some of the things that had come out of the earlier work. And I also began in the late 90s to research effective or successful teaching with colleagues at the University of Western Sydney, Paul Ayres and Wayne Sawyer in particular. In 2000, I was at the time state president of ACE in New South Wales, and I was asked by the minister to develop a new teaching award, a quality teaching award, which would cover the early childhood, primary, secondary, TAFE and university sectors, government, non-government. So I chaired the working party responsible for that. It had two briefs. One was to recognise exemplary teachers, but the other was to research their practice. And that led to a project which is ongoing. I chaired it until mid-2007 when I came down here to Victoria. And it's been quite significant in road testing a lot of the ideas that I'm going to be talking about tonight. It was based, for example, on a set of standards, professional teaching standards, which have been developed under the leadership of Paul Brock, involving AARE, ACSA, and ACE. And we used those standards as a sort of frame for what we were doing. Probably the next significant thing was that in 2000, the year 2000, colleagues at the University of New England, Western Sydney, and the Department of Education in New South Wales won an ARC grant to examine processes in schooling leading to outstanding educational outcomes in years 7 to 10. And that four-year project produced a wealth of material, and one of the key things that I took out of that was a lot of work on leadership. Turnaround schools, low SES schools, schools that have become very, very successful. Probably the next significant thing in this journey, if you like, was in 2002, I was appointed to the interim committee which set up the New South Wales Institute of Teachers as being the sole teacher education rep, and we developed the standards and the processes that are now in place there. Also in 2002, I was asked to join a national Commonwealth inquiry into teaching and teacher education, which Brendan Nelson had established. And again, I was the only teacher educator on that, so you're always sort of fighting a bit of a battle to convince people that, no, in fact, this is the way it really is. But that was a very good experience too, in terms of giving me background to where I am with this today. In 2008 at ACER, myself and colleagues Lawrence Ingvarson and Elizabeth Kleinhens won a tender to map the graduate teachers across Australia for ATRA, Australasian Teacher Regulatory Authorities. And then later that year, we were asked by DEWA, we won a tender with DEWA, to both map and consolidate the teaching standards at the various levels across Australia, including leadership standards and principal standards. And that work was an important precursor for the current national ATSL standards. So in that time since, I've continued to work very much in the area of quality teaching, leadership, teachers' professional learning, and working with various bodies in Australia and overseas. In 2010, I was asked by ATSL to conduct a national piloting of the principal standard, and there were 10 projects involved with that across Australia. So that's where I'm sort of coming from, and that's the reason for giving that list of involvements, I suppose. It's a platform that goes back about 20 years, and I think it's an important base for what I'm going to say today. Now, I want you to hold this thought in your mind for the remainder of this particular exercise. I think we're all fascinated with real estate to one degree or another. Okay. Now, just a bit of background, and up until the mid-60s, the view was that schools make almost no difference to student achievement, which is basically largely predetermined by socioeconomic status, family circumstances, and so-called innate ability. And the Coleman Report of 66 was probably instrumental in that view, but research since has really refuted that quite strongly. We know that SES and family background do exert an influence on student achievement, but they're not a life sentence, which was the earlier thinking. We know that teachers, teaching and schools, and I put can in brackets there because can make a significant difference to student learning and development. And as a result, since the 80s, we've been really much on this track. Work from the OECD, for example, various national and international reports on teacher quality. I put this to you, and I sort of came to this conclusion a year or two ago, that I think from the research that we've been doing over a period of time, we've got a pretty good idea what good teaching looks like. We've got a pretty good idea how teacher expertise develops. The work of David Belinner and so on has been instrumental there. But we also know that teacher quality varies widely. It varies in two senses. The first is that no one comes out of their teacher training being a fully formed autonomous professional. So it varies as we develop our expertise, but it also varies from teacher to teacher. And in fact, it varies more within schools than between schools. So the big issue for us is, well, how do you get a quality teacher in every classroom? And this is a quote from something that Lawrence Ingvarson, who unfortunately isn't here tonight, and Elizabeth Kleinhens and I did for the Business Council of Australia, which I'll refer to a little bit. I'm not going to engage in conference karaoke. You're perfectly capable of reading that. But I will read the last bit. To make best practice common practice. That's the aim of the exercise. Now, I find the Melbourne Declaration a particularly good frame, because when we start talking about evidence, for example, there's a bit of a sort of Pavlovian response that it's all about standardised testing and so forth. Now, the Melbourne Declaration governs all of us, all systems in Australia. And when I talk to groups of teachers and so on, as I do frequently, the level of awareness is not terribly high. And yet it's a very, very good frame. And it comes from earlier work, the Adelaide Declaration and the Hobart Declaration, roughly 10-year intervals prior to it. First goal, very succinctly summarised, is that Australian schooling promotes equity and excellence. And whether we're talking as a nation or we're talking as an individual school, that's a very, very good frame. What are we doing about excellence? In other words, lifting the bar, if you like, lifting achievement overall. How do we know we're doing it? Where's the evidence? And then what are we doing about equity? And there is this tension between, if you like, raising the bar and closing the gap. And there is some evidence that, you know, we do well on international measures such as PISA, but we are slipping back a little bit. Combination of two things. Other countries are coming on and overtaking us to some degree, but also we're slipping back a little bit, particularly at the top end. So that's a challenge for us. And again, within every school, as well as the nation as a whole, all students become successful learners. That's the academic side, if you like. Confident, creative individuals, that's the personal side. Active, informed citizens, that's the social side. So it's a very, very good frame that can be used from anything from a classroom to a nation. Now, John mentioned this book, and I'd been involved, as I mentioned, in a whole lot of research over a period of time, and wanted to put this in one slim volume. It had to be less than a certain number of pages so we could sell it for less than $40, all those sort of pragmatics. But it was really about speaking directly to people about real teachers, real schools, an evidence base, what actually does work. And since it's been published at the end of 2008, I think it's up to about 7 or 8 reprints the last time I looked. So it's been encouraging how that's been accepted. This is just a quote from page one. And it's an odd thing to have to say, but in actual fact, you don't have to go back too far to remember a time when you could sort of sit there during a staff development activity for a day and you sort of play bingo. When will teaching and learning be mentioned? When will students be mentioned? Usually it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something. Our focus was elsewhere. It wasn't on teaching and learning. But in fact, the good teachers, of course, the good schools have always had that focus. Now, in the book, there's a very, very simple little model. But I think, it's a useful frame. What do you see in successful classrooms, faculties, schools, even systems? You see a central focus on teaching and learning, obviously, but every student is known as a learner and a person. That's the academic and the personal. Now, in some classrooms, in some schools, the focus is more on one than the other. It might be on the learning side. Okay, we are a school of high standards. We want to get as many people as possible to get 99 point whatever and get into medicine at Melbourne University. Or we focus more on the person here. And often the language is a giveaway. You know, difficult area, unemployment, social issues and so on. When you start to hear that sort of language, it's a language which condemns students to underachievement. It's basically a low expectations model. Now, I've done a lot of work in low SES schools that are very successful, and they get that balance right, learner and the person. So every student needs to be known by somebody. And it's a tragedy that some kids go through a week, a month, even a term, even longer, without a personal contact being made with the teacher, getting to know them, and getting to know the teacher as well, which is quite important. So what else do you see? You see leadership as being the big enabler. You can have good teaching without having a good school. You can't have a good school without good leadership. And when we talk about leadership today, we talk about leadership in terms of the formal positions of leadership, but also what we would call distributed leadership, teacher leadership. Because every teacher is a leader. When they take a classroom, they're a leader. When they serve on a committee, when they take a sporting group, a music group, they're a leader. So leadership is the big enabler. It's a lever. to improve what happens in schools. What else do you see? You see professional learning as being almost an ongoing fixation. There's no coincidence that the most successful teachers, faculties, schools are never satisfied. They don't sit back and say, we know everything, we've got it worked out. They're continually pushing ahead, which is why they're successful in the first place. And finally, you see quality teaching, which again is another yin and yang type situation. The quality of the teacher, the quality of teaching, and how they reinforce each other. Now, I want to unpack those a little bit before I get to my main argument, which is about teaching standards and how we can utilise those. Just very quickly. I like that quote. It's very succinct. You can see 1997, been around for a while. And this is from our BCA report, Report for the Business Council of Australia. Thanks. So there's a number of agendas there. There's a national agenda, there's a bigger picture, but there's also the individual student. Just another quote for you that I like as well. So every child is entitled to good teaching, but we certainly need to get good teaching where it's needed most and where it can actually make the most difference, in other words, off a low base. Now, just a little bit about professional learning, another part of that triangle that I showed you earlier, and again, a fairly ruthless summary. Fad, fantasy, idealism, ideology or rhetoric. I use witchcraft sometimes and superstition. Now, what do we need? Well, in terms of pre-service and in-service education, if we can put the two of them together, the first thing is obviously a very strong evidence base. We have to know what we're doing works. I think the next thing that comes through strongly in terms of a necessity, if you like, a need, is close, respectful, productive, meaningful partnerships. There's been too much division between the various stakeholders and the various sectors. I think we need to be able to produce graduates at both levels who are critical users and increasingly gatherers of research and data. Put the fads, superstitions, habits, trendy nonsense to the test. Unfortunately, we are suckers for, you know, whatever comes along and seems attractive and shiny and new. I've mentioned knowing every student as a learner and a person, and that includes all the way through. I mean, teachers in a school need to be known as learners and people. Principals do. Clinical approaches, and this is one where, as John mentioned, Phil could wax lyrical for quite a period of time, but certainly being able to diagnose, identify, prescribe, analyse, and that's part of knowing every student as a learner and a person. The so-called individualised approaches to instruction are all predicated on knowing people, knowing them well. And then this business of breaking a cycle, which John also alluded to, breaking the cycle of teachers thinking and teaching as they were taught, and being sucked back into the prevailing culture. And obviously what we're trying to do here with our Master of Teaching graduates is to break those sorts of cycles. And I think above all though, its impact on student learning and development, because that's what we're really about. It's not just about getting the teaching practice right. It's a bit like saying, well, I taught them but they didn't learn. Well, the operation was a success but the patient died. Okay? We have to really look at what the impact is. Now, this is the sort of traditional approach to teacher learning that many of us went through, and it's a sort of linear type journey, if you like, development of expertise, ad hoc in many cases, you know, luck of the draw where you get sent, what sort of reception you get. Increasingly, though, we're seeing these sorts of approaches. Now, action research has been around for a while. Its younger sibling, action learning, is more recent, where people are actually being assisted to conduct research in their schools on problems of importance to them, and I'll get to that in a moment. We can't leave mentoring to chance, so we're looking at more formal relationships there. There's the issue of professional standards, of course, and certification, both at mandatory and voluntary levels. That's going to increasingly drive professional learning in the years to come. The notion of professional learning modules that I've been involved in from the Australian College of Educators, BASTO, various other places. The notion of learning communities has been around for a while. The notion that an organisation like a school can learn, if you like, the synergy is there. But increasingly, we're talking about communities of practice. So it's not just individual schools, but schools being linked and schools being linked to other bodies as well in terms of learning, information, sharing and so forth. I would sort of summarise the trends in teacher learning thus. I take this probably back to the mid-70s for two reasons. One, I can barely remember them. That's when I started teaching. But also that's when the funding really started flowing through for in-service. Up to that time, it was really left to the individual. I think those are all pretty self-explanatory. Now, the left-hand column will continue to need for certain things, but I think we need to sometimes distinguish between the administrative stuff, the mandatory reporting aspects and all of that from the actual professional learning, if you like. Context is important, but context can be a swamp. It's very easy sometimes to justify your lack of action on the basis of, oh, well, these kids, this area, this school or whatever. But certainly, you know, the idea of off-the-shelf packages, which some of us endured during the 90s, we've moved beyond that, fortunately. A lot of on-site learning embedded. Obviously, we're concerned about outcomes or impacts. It's much more an interactive model of learning. The external partner rather than the external expert. And a very good example of this was the Australian Government Quality Teaching Program, which myself and two colleagues from UTS, Laurie Brady and Peter Orbison, evaluated. More community learning. Much more learning is collaborative than was the case previously. Much more about solving problems, problems of importance, identifying, prioritising, attacking those. And it's not just about changing things, it's about changing people, what people know, think, value, can do. And that's possible. And when we did the evaluation of the AGQTP and went around the countryside, we saw many, many people in their 40s and 50s who were, by their own admission, had been re-energised through involvement in that project. And people said to us straight up, you know, the topic of conversation in the staff room has changed. It used to be gardening, golf and superannuation. You know, now we're talking about teaching and learning. We used to complain about Year 9, now we're talking about teaching them. Action learning, doing research, and obviously that student learning focus, which was largely absent before for some strange reason. Oops, I've got to get myself back again. All right. Yeah, a bit on leadership, because as I said, it's the enabler, it's the lever, and just a few quotes I've gathered, which I like, including there from the late Ken Rowe, who was a colleague at ACER. Here's one from John Hattie. So you can see a slightly different emphasis there on maybe what leadership was conceptualised as being maybe 5 or 10 years ago. And I've done a range of projects involving talking to people about leadership and why they got into leadership, and in some cases it's the negative example. Well, you know, I could do better than that. And such has been such a poor example. One from Bill Mulford. So I think those quotes show you a bit of the flavour for the redirection of leadership, the reorientation of leadership in schools. And one more, and because it's me, it's a longer quote. I'm allowed to do that. Okay, so that gives a little bit of a flavour. Leadership has direct and indirect influences, but it's all about creating the conditions in which teachers can teach and students can learn. So these are the essential messages from this first part, which is the sort of foundation for what I want to move to. We're starting to realise that data is our friend. It was seen to be our enemy for a while, but I think we've moved through that, and people are now increasingly using data of all sorts, not just standardised tests, which is the default position, in fairly sophisticated ways for diagnostic purposes and so forth. And the vision thing, everyone got bashed over the head with vision during the 1990s. You had to have a vision. For some people, it ended up being a nightmare. But anyway, vision's nice. It's knowing where you're going. And if you don't know where you're going, well, you're probably not leading. But it needs to rest on evidence. So how can we engage then with the AITSL agenda, particularly the new standards that we've got? I want to look at two things to begin with, the key role of standards and also this issue of salary career structures that really do drive, recognise, reward professional accomplishment. And the argument, obviously, is that a new architecture is needed. What's a standard? Well, literally, it's something that you hold up to other people that says what you believe in. It illustrates, it's symbolic of what you believe in. And it's important internally in terms of your own values and what you believe, but it's also important in what it projects outside. Now, there are two broad, if you like, groups of standards. And our early thinking on standards was governed by this one to some degree, minimum specifications, and I'll come back to that point. But we've also got standards for people, and these are to do with things like professional knowledge, capabilities, actions. Now, I stole this from Ken Leithwood because he had talked about first and generation leadership standards in one of his papers with Steinbeck, and I just want to apply it here. The first generation professional teaching standards, and we've been developing these in Australia for quite some time, tended to be bottom up. In other words, let's look at all the duties that people do and let's make a list of them. So you get a shopping list. Paul Brock often talks about atomising with these sort of first generation standards. It leads you to a competencies approach. Well, if we can get a list, we can check it off. And if we can check it off, we can say we've complied in some ways. So it's a sort of minimal compliance model. And of course, it's got the notion of standardisation. And it's got the notion of making a judgment call on somebody. Now, the second generation standards, and I think we've moved out of that one, although not everybody has, because end of July I was in England speaking at one of the universities over there about this. And when I mentioned standards, people sort of made the sign of the cross and got very, very worried. Because for them, there was no empowerment, there was no involvement. Standards were being imposed upon them by bureaucracies. There was no involvement in the profession in writing the standards. These were things that were being used to hit them over the head with. And I was trying to explain how we'd moved through that process and we're now at the sort of second generation level. Didn't go down terribly well. It's more top down. When I say top down, I mean we start with the big ideas. We start with things like, what do we want to achieve as a nation? Charter for the teaching profession, the Melbourne goals, for example. And then we move down from those big ideas. And the sort of things you see are these, domains, capabilities, elements. They're called different things sometimes, but basically this is what it's about. And the domains are the major aspects of the role. The capabilities are the things that we want to develop. They tend to be aspirational rather than checklist type. Let's tick these things off. The elements of what make up the role need to be illustrative but not exhaustive, because the more, somewhat of a paradox here, the more you detail what people do, the more people are likely to say, I'm not there. You haven't got the one thing that I do or the two things that I do. So it's an incomplete list. So we're trying to get something which is less prescriptive, more dynamic, more future-focused and aspirational, and also contextual as well. We're trying to get away from that first generation that I gave you there. And certainly more higher order than, say, duty statements or codes of practice, which still have their role to play. So in Australia, we've had a couple of decades of work here, and there was important work. The Maths Teachers Association, the Science Teachers Association, there were some ARC grants, people like Lawrence Ingvesson were heavily involved with that. And we ended up with many, many standards and frameworks. And when we started doing the mapping exercise for ATRA and DEWA, we were struck by the sheer number of these. Everybody had some standards, but they were a bit of a mixture of content and performance. Content in that they sort of specified what people need to know, do, value, etc. But there wasn't a notion of, well, what's good performance look like? You know, how can we actually make a measurement against this? Different models, various uses and abuses in some cases. But I'd suggest that the work hasn't been wasted. We've got common, largely generic standards now, but all that earlier work was very, very important because it got people thinking about education. It got people thinking about what they actually did, what they valued, what they were trying to achieve. So, you know, some people were disappointed in some ways in how it turned out, but as I said, that work hasn't been wasted, and we now are certainly migrating to the second generation of standards. So, what's it all about? Well, surely it is about student learning. That's the major focus of all of this. What's wrong with the current system? Well, there isn't a current system. That's the first point. If we look at salary career structures for teachers across Australia, they've got all different conceptions, labels, forms. We've tried in various ways to recognise and reward the classroom teacher, the good classroom teacher who may well stay in the classroom, rather than the old method of, well, if you want more status, salary, and so on, you leave the classroom. The advanced skills teacher is a good example of a national initiative that pretty much fell on its face. It was implemented in different ways right across the countryside. In some cases, it was taken very, very seriously. People had to almost apply for these. But at the end of the day, the AST was one or two increments on top of a salary scale, an incremental salary scale. And those early attempts have not been really encouraging. And then you get the simplistic stuff. Well, we'll just pay teachers on merit. Well, start to unpack what that means. Or we'll pay them by results. Use NAPLAN. Those one-off type approaches are also doomed to fail. The one-off bonuses I'll get to later. The notion of rewarding punishing schools makes little sense when we know that teacher quality varies more within than between schools. We also do want to encourage schools as a whole to improve, and yes, we want to some degree support that, but rewarding and punishing whole schools is problematic. You know, friends of mine who are principals of low SES schools, for example, would tell you that if they did too well, they would lose resources, you know, that they'd have people taken away from their schools. So rather than some schools, we hear, you know, when the NAPLAN tests come around, they get their less able kids to stay at home. In this particular case, when testing came around, you got your more able kids to stay at home. Because it would cost you $100,000, $200,000. Now, the incremental salary career structures basically go back to the industrial ages. You know, the idea that first year apprentice, second year apprentice, third year apprentice, or first year clerk, second year clerk, third year clerk, annual increment. You get to the top and everybody's the same. So 8 to 10 years out, everybody's the same. Same salary, everything plateaus. At present, more than 3/4 of Australia's teachers are on the top of those incremental salary scales. And that's partly a function of the age structure, but it's also the salary career structure as well. They earn less than 1.5 times the salary of a beginning teacher. That difference is too small. When we look at, for example, OECD countries, we look at even near neighbours like Japan and South Korea, it's usually the order of about 1.75 to twice the salary of a beginning teacher for people at the top. So that's the first thing. It's a very flat hierarchy and the difference is too small. There's also a hidden resignation spike, and I picked this up when I was on the New South Wales Teacher Education Council, and we saw some of the data coming back in, and my background a long way back is geography economics, and I sort of started looking at this, looking at the demographics, and you know, there was an unmistakable exit when people got to the top of the salary scale. And who were these people in many cases? The most able people. They got to the age of 32, 33, they looked around, it's now or never. And off they went. Whereas we know about the resignation in the first 2 or 3 years of teaching, which can be anything from 15 to 25% depending on the system. Now, Berliner's done a lot of work on this business of how teachers develop expertise, and basically, you know, competence takes about 2 to 3 years, but a high level of skill takes 5 to 7 years and a great deal of work. And not everybody may get there, or certainly get there at the same rate. And that sort of thinking underpins the standards that we've got now. Again, this is another quote from our BCA report. So the key thing, the key argument is that rather than these one-shot wonders, I would just raise the entry levels to teaching, or we'll pay people by results, or we'll sack board teachers, or we'll do this and do that. We really need to hit teacher quality at every key point of leverage. The quality of who goes in, the quality of the program, the quality of the in-school experience, the quality of induction orientation to teaching, the quality of supervision, ongoing professional learning, and so forth. The second thing to say here is that assessing teachers' performance is a lot more complex than many people would believe. And people who don't work in education find it difficult to believe that you just can't do it. But the fact is, we're not making nuts and bolts. We're not selling insurance policies. They're things that aren't easy to quantify, but it can be done. The mistake we've made is that when we've attempted to assess teacher quality, we've done it in very ineffective ways. Now, the National Bonus Scheme for Teachers. I did speak about this at a conference in Canberra, and Peter Garrett was in the front row. But he mightn't have heard what I said. Cost is about $425, but administering it, you can almost double it. But some of the issues. If we're going to do it properly. The school, the quota for the school will be the default position. Oh, well, you're the principal, you've got 30 teachers, you can give out three. I can't see this attracting, retaining and helping the overall improvement in teacher quality for this simple reason, basically. It might be a pleasant surprise for some people, but if it's not done well, you know what the reaction is going to be in schools if the wrong people get it. It's a one-off thing, all those sorts of issues. I think it's a real missed opportunity because for that amount of money and for the money that's been spent on reducing class sizes, that's another story, but for those two areas in particular, the money could have been much better spent in, for example, piloting a scheme to operationalise the LEED level of teacher standards and certification, which I'll talk about in a moment. But I know, I understand politics. So, can we combine two agendas, the National Teaching Standards and Certification, and this issue of how do we attract, develop, retain, reward our best teachers? Now, I mentioned the report that we did for the Business Council Australia in 2008, and shortly after that was released, or several months afterwards, AITSL released its framework, and it was broadly consistent with what we were saying, which was good. So, what would a new national salary career structure look like? What would be the dangers? What would be the things to achieve? We suggested, and the four levels, of course, are graduate, proficient, highly accomplished, and LEED. We said that in an ideal world, you probably have about 10% at the LEED level. Now, the bonus scheme is supposed to reward the top 10%. That's why I said it's a bit of a missed opportunity. The highly accomplished level, about 30%. Now, both of those are optional. Now, when I say those figures, this is not a quota, right? These are indicative, and that's something that we would sort of move to over time. It might take 10 years to do that. And over time, there'd be people moving out one end and coming in the other. Not everybody would get to the LEED level. Not everybody would get to the highly accomplished level. So roughly 60% would be teachers at the proficient registered level. Proficient or registered after getting their graduate qualifications. So you maybe 10 years for approximate equilibrium. Now this was the structure that we suggested in our report. So you've got your provisionally registered teacher, and some of this language is inconsistent with what we have now because this was prior to that. Our provisionally registered teacher comes out and their salary is X, if you like. The beginning salaries for teachers are roughly equivalent to similar professions. They're not too bad. It's what happens afterwards, the problem. So the registered teacher might be able to get up to maybe 1.25. Now, there would be a salary scale between getting there and the next level of accomplished teacher. Not everybody would leave that level, but in that particular range, there'd be obviously the usual things about annual performance appraisals and all those sorts of things, and you'd need to maintain your registration by demonstrating your professional learning and accomplishment. But the key thing here is that the accomplished teacher, or up to the accomplished teacher level, a teacher could earn up to twice the salary of a beginning teacher. As I said, at the moment it's less than 1.5, and that difference is too small. Now, for those who got accomplished teacher status, they could then have access to a salary scale that would take them up to maybe 2.5 times the salary of a beginning teacher, that 30% or so. And then you've got your lead level, where they might get 2.5 or more. Now, everybody immediately goes straight to that and gets the calculator out and says, yes, we're all going to be getting 110, 120,000 and so on. And that's what tends to happen. But in this particular case here, no, it's a process where professional learning is matched against standards, accomplishment is demonstrated, people are rewarded as they go through. And then, of course, you've got the issue of school leadership as well. Now, a pipe dream. Because at the moment, across Australia, all the systems are different. We've got level threes and level fours and teachers of exemplary practice, and New South Wales has got a pilot scheme at the moment with highly accomplished teachers, but that's going to run out in a couple of years, so they go back to being in the classroom. It's a mess. All right? It's a real mess. There's no common structure. There's no common understanding. Universities have had something like this for a long time. Five levels, about 25 salary steps. I'd suggest in that previous diagram you probably would have the equivalent of about 25 salary steps. Still allows for flexibility. They're all individual awards at universities, but we understand the structure. So if you want a head of department at one university, you might say, well, the person has to be an associate professor or a professor. In other case, not so. Likewise, with that structure that I just outlined there, I won't go back to that, you can't mandate. You can't say you have to have this level for this position. It has to be left to employers. Schools vary considerably in their size and context and their needs and so forth, their finances. So in one case, for example, a Catholic school, high school might say, we need a new coordinator of science and we want a lead level person or a highly accomplished. That sort of thing can't be mandated. And then that sort of ratio is consistent with what we were sort of suggesting from, you know, a beginning teacher year one up to a lead teacher, maybe 2.5 to 2.75 the salary. Now, some issues. We need true performance standards, not just content standards, and we're still having trouble with that notion. It's capabilities, not just competencies. We've got to move away from that tick the box type thing. Contexts of teaching and leadership are important and do have to be taken into account. But where do you draw the line? That's the key thing there. How are people going to be assessed? Now, is it simply going to be the word of a principal, or is it going to be the portfolio, the dreaded portfolio, which can be a wonderful thing or can be a work of fiction? How are you going to do it? How are you going to get validity to the whole exercise? Reliability. How are you going to compare different systems? Different teachers in different locations, different teachers in different positions. A librarian with a school counsellor, for example. Who assesses? And ideally, over time, the profession should be involved in that process. When we ran the Quality Teaching Awards in New South Wales, what we did very, very quickly is once people started winning those awards, they became our assessors. They worked with us in doing the assessment in schools. And that was terrific for them, and it was terrific for us because they had that knowledge of, you know, what a top history teacher should look like today. And then the portability thing, the mutual recognition between systems. If I'm a highly accomplished teacher and I go from one system to another, do I take that with me? Does my salary reflect that when I go to my new position? Or do I go in there with my eyes open and maybe get a lower level? How long do you keep it for? You retain it. And everybody says 5 years because 5 years seems to be a nice figure. I've never really seen the reason why, but it just seems to be five. The maintenance there, well, okay, how do you keep it? Demonstrated professional learning, demonstrated accomplishment, they're all particular issues. The big one, though, is integration into existing awards and salary structures, because they're all different and they're all discrete. Now, we're starting to see some slow movement in that direction, but it could be facilitated. The cost is an issue. That model I put up is not cost neutral. You know, it's going to cost some money. However, when we look at what we've spent our money on up to now, it's not insurmountable. When we look at the money that's been spent, as I said, in the class sizes area, which we've spent an enormous amount of money on, and to date there's no evidence really it's made much difference. We know that, you know, there's a small effect size for reducing class sizes, otherwise we'd have classes of 100 or 1,000. But the fact is, reducing classes by more than one or two is very, very costly. And unless you change your pedagogy, nothing much happens. Now, because I'm a mind reader, those of you who are teachers, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, yes, but if I could choose the people to lose out of my class, the one or two, it would make a big difference. And you'd be absolutely right, because absence of disruptive students has a fairly large effect. So cost is an issue, although there will be some savings as our current aged teaching population moves out the door. Now, the assessment for certification, just in a bit more detail. Valid, measure what it's supposed to measure. Reliable, can do it consistently. Credible, people have faith in it. Needs to be based upon the national standards and include observation of teaching. Some of the projects I've been involved with, including the Quality Teaching Awards, we made sure we went and watched people teach. I can't see how you can judge quality otherwise. But sometimes we made that mistake, if you like. And when we went around the state and went and visited people teaching, in just a few cases, we realised that, no, this was not a quality teacher. There were other reasons why they'd been nominated. But in the vast majority of cases, yes, we could understand what they were doing and where they were doing it and all of those sorts of things. So it's got to be that balance between on-site and off-site. Everybody looks to the National Board in the USA. That's a highly technical approach. The numbers that have been through are small. It's got a lot of, you know, credibility and reliability and all those sorts of things. But we're looking at something that's mainstreaming. Because one of the problems with early schemes to recognise and reward classroom teachers is they have not been mainstream. They've been a little side alley. They haven't been a career architecture, a highway. The profession's got to be meaningfully involved. The assessors' observers must be fully trained, and that will take time and money and brains. But we can do it. And over time, many people who've been assessed and certified at those levels will become part of the process. And that's where you really start to get traction, ownership, involvement. Seen it happen. So down the track, everybody will be somewhere on this continuum and quite possibly beyond. Depends what happens really at the higher levels of leadership. The lower levels, pragmatics tells you, nationally consistent, but probably at a state and territory basis, a bit like driver's licences. The road rules have pretty much been harmonised, normalised across Australia, but the various states and territories still do their own testing. However, I would really like to see the lead level be truly national. It's high status, it's very important, and likewise, if we could manage it, the highly accomplished level too. As I said, I would have liked to have seen the lead level piloted by now. Now, if this is a lousy process, if the wrong people are selected and the right people miss out, if, for example, it's a rubber stamping exercise and everybody ends up a highly accomplished or lead teacher, the budget's broken, we've wasted all that money and little credibility or gain from the exercise. So that's the one that's really concerning people. When we were doing our earlier work, we went around and we spoke to directors general and secretaries of education and so on. What worried them most was that highly accomplished band, if you like, and what the effects of that would be if, you know, a flood of people went in there, if the processes weren't right. So work needs to be done, but it can be done. That's the important thing. We need to measure teacher performance and growth against the standards, and we need to work out what's threshold performance at each level. Evidence of student learning is the major thing, really. It's the ultimate thing we're trying to do, and the impact of teaching, in other words. We'll need multiple measures. NAPLAN is a very poor proxy for individual teacher quality. And yet, I go to other fora where people get up there and say, well, we'll just use NAPLAN results to judge the quality of teachers. Well, there's a whole range of reasons why that doesn't work. I won't go into them now. Other standardised measures, available measures that, to gather the data that we need. Think about the Melbourne goals, academic, personal, social, to see how we're really going as a school, how we're really going as an individual teacher, and use those key documents as frames. There's some challenges certainly involved with this. I think that second paragraph's most important. Explain and justify their actions. Why do you do things? Why? It's not just an exercise of collecting evidence, but explaining why the evidence has been collected and why it's important. What underpins it? A lot of professional learning, a lot of resource development required here. The assessment should be for teacher learning and development. We talk a lot about this with kids, but the process of going through the assessment process for certification should be a learning experience, not just a judging experience, if you like. And we're going to need all those sorts of things. And it needs to be a broad spread of capabilities and evidence against the standards that reflects the reality of being a teacher. So, I think that the pieces of the puzzle are coming together quite quickly. National curriculum, national testing, national accreditation teacher education courses, national certification for teachers. This notion that you can have a highway, if you like, that's going to drive, recognise, reward people from when they go in right throughout their career, rather than this present situation where people get to the top of these incremental salary scales and then across Australia you've got a mess. I think the ACSL standards are integral to that development. The standards are important in terms of the increased expectations on schools. We need to have a clear understanding of what it is exactly we're asking people to achieve and whether in fact they've achieved that. But we do need that new architecture for professional learning. As I said, there won't be a single award, nor should there be, but we should have a broadly consistent approach to this. Now, if that doesn't happen, then the ACSL standards will be decorative. They won't be generative. They'll be like Christmas decorations. Nice and shiny, and you put them up for a while. Aren't they nice? You cease to see them after a while, then you put them down, put them in a cupboard, and forget about them. Now, we're starting to see some movement here, as I said, slowly, but it could be facilitated. It needs to be facilitated. There's been a bit of pushback already from some of the jurisdictions. At the time a lot of this was set up, all the state and federal government were Labor. And there was a combination of carrots and sticks used to get everybody to sign on the dotted line. But since that time, we've seen some pushback in the areas of curriculum, in the areas of the standards. So really, we have to resist that. As I said, it won't be cost neutral, and there will be a requirement for Commonwealth financial assistance to make it happen. But if it doesn't occur, we'll be left with what we've got now, which is really showing the strain. Do you get what I mean in that last paragraph? Could I add a few more words to it? It's just something to think about. I hope that's just an aberration. And that's a quote from our report. It's time we got serious about teacher quality. And I promise this will be the last word. Now, as I said, I used to be an economics teacher. I understand the notion of monetary stimulus and the fact that the BER was an important response to the global financial crisis. And I get to talk all around the countryside in different states and territories, and I've been in many of these new halls, and they're wonderful. And people are really grateful for them, particularly primary schools and particularly people in the country areas. They would never have had those facilities otherwise. But the fact is, at the moment, the cost of the BER is continuing to rise. It's not finished. Last I heard, it's 17 or 18 billion. Probably higher by now. The partnership spending for quality teaching under COAG, for both quality teaching and for leadership, was $550 million. So we got $18 billion, $550 million. I would have liked to have seen a bit more money put in the other bucket. We could have easily have operationalised these standards. And bringing this right back to SES, and disadvantage and so on. Life isn't fair, but good teaching and good schools are the best means we have of overcoming disadvantage and opening the doors of opportunity for young people. Thank you.
Steve, thank you and congratulations on a superb address. John Dewar at the start talked about turning teaching into a profession and moving to that path, and this is clearly a fundamental component of that. And until we achieve that goal, then we won't be attracting the very best people, another key element of what we need into our profession. This is challenging stuff, the profession's challenging stuff. What you've presented is an integral part of that. Thank you for your address. Please join me in congratulating Steve. Thank you. And this is a memento of the occasion.
Thank you.
We all need a drink, particularly Steve. Please join me outside
Very thanks.
Let's celebrate the occasion. Thank you all for your attendance.